All right, I thought I would start by very briefly going on over some of the general information on the system and then start going through cases. And at this point, every case has been read by four of you, following that table that was posted up on the webpage of your assigned cases. And I was hoping both that you would comment on cases sort of as we were going through the book. It would be much easier if you all had copies of the book, but unfortunately it's out of print, so that's not really an option. That you would comment on cases that had struck you when you were reading it, and then I will also be commenting on cases that struck me. Among the things that are sort of striking about the system, one of the things you keep seeing here are the rules, which I at least interpret as designed to maintain the authority structure within the family, so that we observe that people are required to obey their parents, their senior relatives, aren't let off if they commit a crime because they're ordered to do that, that you get lighter punishments for things you've done to junior relatives, higher punishments for senior relatives. There is a passing comment at one point that people who are traveling, who are living together and sharing property, count as if they were a family, and one implication is that they are not expected to testify against each other. Whether it would actually be illegal in that case, I don't know. One of the things that struck me about this whole system of priority is there's a sense in which two approaches to organizing the world. One of them is the approach of each person has rights over certain things, over yourself and what you own and stuff, and we coordinate by trade, mutual exchange, voluntary association, that sort of stuff. And the other is we have some rule for deciding who can give orders to whom. And if you use the second system and you've got a lot of people involved, you're unlikely to sort of have some formal procedure which says, all right, he's number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. But you need some mechanism for doing that. And one somewhat arbitrary but very simple one is age, which is what they're using among family members of the same generation. And then the generations are another. And that reminded me of one of the interesting features of the British Navy a couple of hundred years ago, which was essentially the same approach with a minor twist, and that is that you have a group of ships that are acting together. Each of them is commanded by a captain. Those captains are all of the same nominal rank. So how do you decide? You want the ships to be coordinating. How do you decide which captain gets to decide what they all do? Anybody know? The answer is, it is seniority defined as how long it is since you became a captain. So if you became a captain the day before I did, the result is that in a joint action, you are, as it were, the commodore. You're the one who's in charge. A day later, not. And they carried that a good deal further because in that particular system, promotions were by strict seniority. So what basically happens is that when you get to the top of the captain's list, either you're finished or you were promoted to be an admiral who has no command, so you're nominally an admiral and are in effect getting a retirement salary, or you're promoted to be a real admiral. But that has to happen before the person below you on the list and so forth. Sort of an odd and interesting system, and you can see that if for whatever reason you don't want to spend a lot of resources arguing about who's best, that that sort of mechanical system has certain advantages as well as some obvious disadvantages. And as I say, they... one way in which the British Navy handled the disadvantage was to say, well, you're an admiral, but I think it was, I don't know what the flag was, but there was some division which amounts to the fact that there's nothing under your command. So you're sort of a nominal admiral, and you presumably get somewhat more retirement pay than if you are a retired captain. In general, there's a system where if you were a captain, you weren't guaranteed a ship. You could be a captain on half pay, which meant you were on shore, had no obligations, half your salary, and were free to do what you pleased until they decided they needed a captain for another ship. It's a system that shows up in a good deal of fiction, some of it pretty good, the most recent being the Aubrey Maturin books, which I gather were made into a popular movie, and it's sort of an intriguing human organization, the British Navy during roughly the Napoleonic Wars. But going back to China, another feature of the system, and one which I think seems a bit odd to us, is the way in which so much attention goes to the tale of what offense gets what punishment. So that rather than having very broad classes like theft or assault, they have the offense of making gunpowder in order to sell it to small salt smugglers. I think I've got that one right. And they have the offense, I don't know, I have to go through the details, but you just, as you go through the cases, these people are citing statutes, which often don't exactly apply, but which themselves look as though they're intended to apply to a very narrow set of things, and to specify precisely what the punishment is. And in theory, the punishment is determined in detail by the nature of the crime, by the relative status of the parties, and to some extent by the absolute status of the parties. So that if you're a slave, the rules are somewhat different. If you're an imperial clansman or a bannerman or somebody in the various, or the top levels, the situation and the rules are somewhat different. Even with an enormously detailed system of this sort, however, there are always gaps. And thus a large fraction of these cases, you can see that what the court is saying is, well, this is sort of like the case covered by Statute X, but not exactly, so the same punishment but a little bit less, or the same punishment but a little bit more, or the same punishment. And the editors comment on cases where it seems a little odd because it seems it's much closer to Statute Y. Why didn't they use that? And often we don't know. And a further problem, of course, is that this exact mechanical system might give you the wrong answer. And to some degree, that's covered by the whole appeal system, by not just appeals, by the fact that all the heavy punishments go up a level, or if it's really heavy punishment, up all the way to the imperial capital, and there the emperor can exercise mercy, the people below the emperor can decide that you're a case deserving of compassion, and so forth. Also, there's quite a lot of optional stuff in there where the statute says you may be allowed to such and such. If you are the only support of your aged parents, you may be allowed to stay home instead of being exiled 3,000 li away. But on the other hand, if we decide not, you may not do. And similarly, normally women are let off from the more severe punishments in exchange for a cash payment. But there are cases in here where the court says, you know, this woman has behaved very badly. Instead of doing that, lock her up for 3 years or send her into exile, or in some way don't let her get the usual disadvantages. Where do the laws come from? There are official statutes. There are sets of statutes that each dynasty has passed. They're modified over time. There are then sub-statutes, some of which appear to be actual decrees from the imperial level, and some of which seem to be what we would think of as precedent. That is to say, somebody saying, well, look, in such and such a case, they decided to apply by this, and then some of those precedents, next time you revise, get incorporated into the code. And one of the things which isn't very clear here, I don't know if there are any actual pictures of the law code in this book or not, but that what you really have is sort of a core of the code surrounded by, in a different color, various levels of commentary. And I was reminded of that when I was looking at the Talmud, which is the Jewish law equivalent, as it were, where you've got the Mishnah, which is the sort of, in some sense, core load code, and then a whole bunch of commentary around it. And I gather that you've got other documents in that tradition where you've got one thing and then the commenter on the commenter and so forth. And of course, the Chinese had printing, which simplifies all this matter pretty early, and there were apparently printed codes in multiple colors showing both the rules and some experts, whoever the expert was at the time, opinion of them. And of course, you're spending 3 years reading stuff like that, only we call them case books with rules and commentary. These are supposed to be more complete because they're supposed to have all the rules. Punishments. What are the main punishments that we observe in this system? Yep. Being beaten by a light or heavy bamboo.
Military servitude.
Becoming essentially a slave of the military some far off place.
And some kind of exile.
Exile to some specified distance. Penal transportation. I guess it's a little unclear whether the exile to a distance, whether in practice they're actually going to make you work when you get there or just keep you away.
Then there were things like death by slicing and
yes.
the extermination of all extended
relatives? Yes. Well, death by slicing is what is popularly referred to as the death of the thousand cuts. It's passed into our language in that form. And it's a little unclear exactly what it was, and I think there's some suggestion in here that it may have varied in practice in what it was, but at least at the high end is something like torturing to death, basically. And there is strangulation and decapitation. Yes?
What is strangulation after the...
Assizes. Yes, that's discussed, I think, in some detail in the reading for the previous class. This is a system where any of the penalties after the assizes, you are basically held until a certain time when there's a further legal procedure. And that legal procedure is quite likely for a capital offense to end up commuting something other than a capital offense. So you have, I think, twice a year, I believe. I think there's a spring and an autumn assizes, if I've got it right. Yep. Let me give it for a moment. As best I can follow it, I think this is all happening in Peking. I think the prisoners who have been nominally condemned to a capital punishment are sent to Peking and locked up somewhere. And then when the assizes comes around, they are sorted according to their offenses. And the sort of lowest level are told, oh, we're going to commute. You're deserving of compassion. We'll commute your punishment to 3 years penal servitude or to some slightly lower than execution. And there's a middle group. Then there are other people whose name go on a big sheet of paper, I guess. And in some ceremony, the emperor draws a circle on that sheet of paper. And it's a little ambiguous whether the names inside the circle are executed or the names outside the circle are executed. But if you're on the right part of the circle, they decide not to execute this year. Next year, they do it again. Repeat. If you get by 3 years, you automatically are commuted to the next lower punishment. So it's a sort of a weird system which looks as though part of it is by chance, although it's possible that the people who are drawing up that sheet of paper are actually figuring out who goes in the center and who goes in the periphery according to how serious the crime is there. We don't know that. But it looks like a combination of an administrative decision of do you deserve some subcapital punishment, even though we've said it's going to be capital, along with this bizarre, maybe magical or random mechanism for selecting out which ones actually get executed. And there are some, I think I saw an estimate somewhere in the book that of the people who got nominally capital after the assizes sentences, only about 10% were actually executed. I don't know if that's right. I mean, we don't have that kind of data, but that was someone's estimate that got mentioned, I think, somewhere in this book. So that sort of is what's going on. It seems a little bit weird. Now, we have in certain senses the same thing, that you have somebody who gets a death sentence and then spends many years on death row, and then maybe somebody manages to get him pardoned or to get the case reheard or whatever. So it's nothing like this formalized diversion. And as I think I mentioned before, the famous English Bloody Code of the 18th century, where essentially all serious crimes were capital, was again one where capital didn't really mean capital because you were sentenced to hang by the neck until dead. Now go home and don't do it again. Sometimes you hung by the neck until dead. They didn't execute anybody, but quite a large fraction. And I think the numbers from the one study I saw suggest a majority of those who received death penalties were not hanged. They were transported or allowed to enlist in the military if there was a war or just pardoned. Yeah.
There's an interesting story from one of the first cases in our crim law book where there's three sea captains. For one sea captain, some other crew, the youngest one that's 18 gets sick, and they're deciding, stuck off to see whether they should eat him or not. And they eventually kill him and eat him. They draw straws,
yes.
Maybe, but the captain decided his name shouldn't be amongst the three or four straws.
Yeah.
They eat him, and then a week later, they're found by a ship. They go back to England. They all get sentenced to hang or to die.
Yep.
They all get
That's a rather weird case, I think. There's a book on that called Cannibalism in the Common Law, which I think is the same case you're describing. And it's a weird case because it seems as though the sailors all believed that this was legal. That is, that their view was, the custom of the sea that when you're starving to death, that probably you're supposed to draw straws. but that killing and eating somebody when the alternative was all of you dying of starvation was legitimate, and they come back and make no secret about it. And I think if you read the book on it, it looks as though the case was heavily rigged by the prosecution, that the jury was manipulated in various ways, because presumably it was fairly commonly believed this was legitimate, and they were trying to establish a precedent that it wasn't. So if you're curious, as I say, the book is Capitalism and the Common Law. It's probably the same case you're describing, though I don't swear it is. And it's quite an interesting story, as it were, and one in which one ends up, I think, more on the side of the sailors than of the prosecutor. But yeah, now you had a question, yes?
I'm going to ask you about the drawing of
the yes. One of the striking things, though, reading these cases, how many cases are there in which these are all, in effect, appeals court cases? How many are there where they question the factual determinations of the lower court? No, almost none of them.
They were questioning everyone who,
They question the legal decisions of the lower court. But there's one case I mentioned where they say this was a case where two husbands killed their wives. And each of them claims justification, that the wife had insulted the husband's mother, I think. It was one of them, at least, or hit her or something. But according to the higher court, the lower court had made no effort to verify that it actually happened. It's pretty obvious that if you kill your wife, you're going to want to invent a story, and your mother may be happy to back up your story, especially if you didn't like your wife very much anyway, and suggests going back and reinvestigating. But I think if you look through the cases, there are very few cases where there's any question about the facts at all. The question is always about how the existing legal system... If you have other examples, point them out if you remember ones. Yes. Yes. There was this one weird case which sounds as though it might have been witchcraft trial, though it's hard to tell, where supposedly he sucked the marrow from the bones of 19 baby girls.
And the emperor intervened specifically
to say how dreadful this was, and that not only should he be tortured to death, but they should send the message by fast courier to have him tortured to death. The guy was 70 years old, and who knows, he might die before we torture him to death. That would be terrible. And the governor of the province who didn't investigate it initially is going to be severely investigated, and the fact the governor of the province after the issue was raised suggested only executing him and not torturing to death is very suspicious, and it's never, there's no explanation in that case of what he actually did.
What I wondered when I read Suck the Marrow was that term as mysterious to them as it is to us now?
It could have been a euphemism. You know, it could mean some kind of sexual act or whatever. It could mean some kind of magical theory that, you know, maybe he was actually, you know, a pediatrician more or less, and he treated kids, and some of the kids died, and someone decided they must have died because he did some magical operation trying to get something from them. I just don't know. We don't know. But it's a weird case because the reactions are so very strong. And yet there's no explanation. But again, all we're getting is the appeals court. If you think about our appeals courts, what's the real rule in our appeals courts? They're supposed to accept the trial of facts results and only look at the law. And here, I don't think they're required to do so, but it's clear that's what's really happening. And it makes a certain amount of sense if you say, look, the people in Peking are more expert in the law code than the local people. But the local people are 800 miles away. We don't have any easy way of investigating it. We can't investigate the facts. We can only investigate the facts only by summoning a whole bunch of people 800 miles to Peking and having a bunch of procedures. So mostly we're going to have to trust the local authorities on that. But, yeah.
I have a question about Cangue.
C-A-N-G-U-E.
Yes.
Yes.
Is there any other crime that would be a punishment?
Yes. Yes, there are a bunch of things. That's one of the relatively low-level punishments. And I think it's, I don't remember if it's described in here, but I think it's some sort of a yoke, which I'm not sure if it immobilizes your arms as well, but at least it's a heavy thing.
It says it does.
What it does?
It says that you only have eye people for that.
Yeah.
It says that there's only a small opening for your face to go in, and
yes.
You may need help like eating and drinking, and there's somehow it's closed, so your arms can't really move. I don't know how.
Yep. Somewhere I saw a description, I don't remember if it was in here or one of the other things I was looking at, but in any case, it's partly immobilizing and partly shaming and inconveniencing device, but you're wearing it typically for what is it, you know, for a month or two or three kind of thing, not for years and years. So I was thinking of it as in a way analogous to the stocks in sort of traditional Western system where you know about the stocks, this early Puritan New England and earlier than that in England, you've got this sort of framework which you go into with your hands and head being held, and maybe he'll don't like you throw rotten tomatoes or something, but pretty clearly under normal circumstances it's not going to kill you, it's just going to humiliate you and such. Yeah.
Well, I saw one in Korea, that's what it is, it's just like a flying thing. There was one case where there were the emperor's oxen were improperly cared for by
yes.
somebody, and one of them died in the sense that I was supposed to be 3 years of servitude, but instead he got two months of whereas any quotations.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because of some of that's the other thing. There's all kinds of clever analogizing to either Israel or.
And sometimes it makes sense of filling in gaps. But there was one of the cases where they pointed out where you've got a statute that's on point and they're ignoring it in order to use an analogy to get a different result. But you also, I mean, there are some sort of somewhat weird things, for all I know it happens in our legal system too, where you have long discussions of things that don't matter. Where you have, do we classify them under statute A or statute B? Well, here are the reasons for A, but here's the reason we decide on B. By the way, they have the same punishment. And there's another case where they say we've got to decide on the following somewhat elaborate grounds what the proper punishment for this offender is. By the way, he's died already. But we still have to decide what the proper punishment is, right? I mean, even if we're not going to apply it. So a lot of that feels, as it were, sort of very bureaucratic, very much as though it's the file, not the real world you care about. And I don't know if any of you noticed, but there's one poor guy who, forgets to stamp an official document that's going into the files and gets a moderately severe punishment for that mistake. So he's a bureaucrat who, you know, doesn't, as it were, dot the I's and cross the T's. And let me see, I think I may be able to find that one to see if they say what the punishment was, but it was something fairly substantial. I don't know. Anyway, yes?
There's a case that I read that was like two guards.
For next year, I'm going to ask people to write down the page numbers when they're taking notes so that I can look. You did. Good for you. Because I can look up the case then.
No, but it was two guards and they had two prisoners and they were taking. One was supposed to be decapitated, one was supposed to be strangled, but there's such a big crowd. They got them confused.
Yes.
Was that such a big deal? That, like,
well,
the
I gather, at least from this book, that on essentially sort of religious or almost magical grounds, having your body mutilated was considered a bad thing. Maybe, I don't know, it makes it harder to get to heaven or something like that, I'm not sure. And strangling is therefore the lesser punishment because your body is still together even though you're dead. So apparently that's why they care. What?
There's also that principle of the body for the body,
yes.
The redemption principle.
Yes.
So, like, for them to get the punishment.
But if they both got executed, that would be all right.
But if one execution is more of an insult.
I don't think so. I think, as far as I can tell from reading this, the redemption really is a death for a death. Because I don't know, one of the cases, which obviously only a few of you read, makes the point that you've got a crime which is planned by A and carried out by B and C. And under the rules, B and C have committed a capital offense. And A has committed an offense just below capital, assuming he didn't himself carry it out. A happens to die before the legal procedure is finished. B and C get slid down to just below capital. So that looks like a case where somehow the symbolic or magical or something like that fact that one of the offenders is paid with his life then means the others don't have to pay with his life. And that may also be relevant to this whole question of the appeal of the assizes. Because if I've got it right, and I'm not certain, I think it's sufficient for redemption that somebody be sentenced to die, not that he has to die. So I think it's the case that you meet the requirements if one of the offenders is sentenced to die, goes off to the assizes, and 3 years later is sent off into exile. I think that still does it.
Yeah, I remember there was one comment where it said something about there being like this older natural, you know, basic principle of the,
yep,
you know, every death for another death. And over time, it had sort of been lost in the formalities for as long as the,
yes,
paperwork was done.
I think that's what's happening, and that sort of one way you could look at the whole assizes system is that one of the things it is the tension between, on the one hand, this sort of traditional rule they aren't willing to ditch of a death for a death, and then for other reasons they want to be fairly careful about not killing, not executing very many people, though not entirely sure why, whether maybe that's also for religious reasons that, you know, you could certainly imagine the emperor saying, well, if I am unjustly exercised somebody, I'll pay for it in heaven or something. I don't know enough about the system to know if that's what's going on, so that you have a way in which you can officially execute people without having to actually execute them, which, again, seems a little bizarre, but nonetheless certainly can happen. So basic court structure is that the minor cases, meaning the ones that involve only being beaten with a bamboo, are settled by the district magistrate, and he has to report them, but he can actually execute the punishment himself, and he only reports them up one level normally. The more serious cases, which are short of capital and short of either homicide or capital. I think homicide, where for some reason the punishment isn't capital, still counts in the most serious category. So the more serious cases are investigated by the district magistrate, reported up one level to the prefecture, which is a bunch of districts. They get a verdict. He conforms it. The provincial governor has to confirm the verdict. The provincial governor has to report it up. But in fact, his confirming it settles the matter, unless, I guess, he gets countermanding orders later, and it then goes back down to be actually implemented at the local. And for a non-capital homicide case, the final decision has to be made in Peking by the board. And for a capital case, you have a final judgment by a court at Peking above the board, has to be confirmed by the emperor, and that's what normally involves this elaborate process, at least if it's after the assizes. In addition, any case that was decided by, that involved officials, had to be ratified by the emperor, and any cases decided by analogy had to go up to Peking to be confirmed, because that was sort of expanding the rules. And where do private individuals come in? A private individual could appeal to a high court in either direction. You can appeal to say, so-and-so is responsible for my son's death, and they didn't do anything to him. Or I think you can appeal if you say, I or somebody was convicted of something and shouldn't have been, or should have gotten a lighter penalty. But it was a very risky process. Did people notice sort of things having to do with the whole issue of trying to sort of call on the court system to do things? There was one quite striking case. People, nobody noticed anything in particular. Let's see if I can dig up the case somewhere. I've got notes on all of the, what I thought were the interesting cases, but there are a lot of them, so finding them is a bit of a pain. Just a minute. Yes. A doctor misdiagnoses the case and uses acupuncture in the wrong way, if I've got, yep? Very good. You remember that case. And so what happens, what's the court's decision, what happens to the doctor, and what happens to the father, who is the one who goes to Peking to try to get justice for the killer of his son?
I believe the doctor got strangulation commuted to money redemption. And the doctor got
father.
Blows.
Yes, the doc. Correct. The father was found to have exaggerated the facts. He was right. Yes. That is to say, the court found the doctor had acted badly. something the son had died. But they found that the father had exaggerated in his complaint. Therefore, he gets 100 blows of the heavy bamboo. The doctor, as I say, nominally gets a capital punishment, but is commuted to 12 ounces of silver. And somewhere in here, I was curious, what does 12 ounces of silver mean? And somewhere I think there's a figure for a laborer's wage, which gets mentioned somewhere in here. And the laborer's wage, I think, is a little below an ounce a day. So you're talking about his punishment is something like a few weeks' wages for a laborer, which is not what we would think of as a crushing punishment. Yeah. Yes.
Which I thought was really, it was interesting. Then they also made a difference between someone, like this dad, reading a case, not this book, the one where he took his son and laid him on the doorstep. There was a dad.
Trying to frame somebody else.
Right.
Yes.
He was so poor that he couldn't afford food, he strangled his son to, make her one less mouth to feed, but then he blamed the guy who wouldn't let him write, so he put the body on the doorstep.
Yes.
And they said there was a difference between doing that crime and blame that person, or doing the crime and then trying to
yes.
And I thought
yes.
That was really interesting.
Yes.
I made sense.
Yes. 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 I also wonder in that case whether he's really trying to get the person convicted or just to shame him.
I think he's trying to shame him. That's what he said. Because he strangled his son and then he laid him on the doorstep so the community would lay blame on the guy.
Who refused to make it. Yeah. Yes.
I didn't look up the wages.
Yeah. Yeah, but that's the problem with that is this is a much, much poorer society.
Right. Yeah,
so, this could be a society where that was the equivalent to a year's salary. I mean, you don't know a priori. And of course, the value of silver changes. I know very little about currency in China in the 19th century, but for example, through the medieval period, typically gold is about 10 times silver. Whereas in modern times, gold has been much higher than that relative to silver. So you don't know a priori.
Silver is such a good investment right now.
That doesn't tell you. It's been what I'm saying. No, if you want to make jewelry as a hobby, you do it in silver. But as an investment, you got to predict what it's going to do, not what it is. Right. Anytime somebody says this is a good investment because it's cheap, you say, well, why is it cheap? Cheap because people don't expect it to get more expensive. If they did, they would have bid up the price. Then you've got to decide for yourself. Yeah.
Kind of on a different subject, but yeah. It seemed really interesting. They kind of had a general category for crimes that couldn't really fit anywhere into the statute.
I think they have three general categories, actually. Yeah.
Doing what ought not to be done,
violating an imperial command, which doesn't require the imperial command actually existed, and there's a third one which I've now forgotten. Yeah.
And it just seemed like that was sort of their last resort if they could find something.
Right. Well, do we have something sort of like that in our system? If you're the local cop and you think somebody is a troublemaker and he hasn't actually done anything obvious, what do you accuse him of? I was thinking of disturbing the peace, but I mean, so we have some fairly broad categories in that sense as well. But all right, let me take a look first as whether I had anything else I was going to say in general.
They also have the 10 abominable crimes, or the 10 abominable offenses.
Yes.
That kind of
yes. And if I remember correctly, I think offenses against your parent are worse than offenses against the emperor, assuming the emperor is not your father, although both are, of course, dreadful. I think that the worst one of all is something. I was killing your father, but some sort of an offense. That they in general seem to take that issue very, very seriously indeed. Which, of course, they should. My children did not be. Yeah. You remember what page it was by any chance? I can look it up. Yes. All right. I will look for that. But they also have.
Oh, but it was the case where the son was punished for the parent's suicide, even though the reason why she committed suicide was because of something she had told the son to do. And I just thought that was really interesting.
In general, you will notice that causing someone to commit suicide basically counts as homicide.
Yeah.
And that's sort of interesting, but that also has some further implications, because that means that one reason to commit suicide is to get revenge on someone. Right? You say, my life is really miserable, it's hardly worth living, and furthermore, if I hang myself and make it clear that it was his fault, with any luck they'll execute him. At least send him into exile or penal servitude or something. So that you do have, in a sort of in a system, if you think about it in the family context, where in one sense the people at the lower end of the totem pole have no power at all, well, they do have that ultimate power, that they can kill themselves and get the person responsible into trouble as a result.
Do you know why they were so... I mean, just the cases that I read, it seemed like a lot of these parents were just prone to just, like, committing suicide if they thought... Like, there was one where it was... I think it was the son, he'd taken out some loan or something for a piece of land or something, and the mom was worried that they weren't going to pay the bills or something about poverty, and then she just committed suicide.
Yep.
It seemed really drastic.
I don't know. That is to say, one thing you've got to remember is that we're not exactly getting a random sample of behavior in China. We're only getting, aside from the selection of cases, we're only getting things that became cases. So all the reasonable parents who said, well, that's too bad, now don't do it again, don't get into the book. So out of 400 million people, you're going to have a lot of odd things happening. But beyond that, it may have been a society where, you know, you can certainly see in principle, if you believe in some sort of a life after death, and your current life is pretty miserable, you might say, all right, you know, better go on to the next stage. You can imagine various circumstances which might affect how common suicide is. Yeah?
There was another case about that where it was under the doing what ought not be done. It was a military officer, I think, who wanted to commit suicide. His teacher had died, and he wanted
yes.
to follow him.
Yes, into the afterlife. That's right. That's right. Yeah, no, I remember that one. That'd be a good example. Yeah. I think that was a Manchu, wasn't it, or... Was it? Do you remember what page it's on? 237.1. Right. Doing what ought not to be done, as you say. Who was deeply grateful to his teacher, both for the latter's long guidance and for his willingness on one occasion to lend Chi Cheng a money to repay a debt. When Chao died, therefore, Chi Cheng A entertained Ethan Manchu, the idea of committing suicide so as to follow and serve his leader in the next world. He accordingly wrote a statement of intent which he presented to the head of his banner so as to obviate the need for any investigation of his death. He's clearly a responsible fellow. He doesn't want to make trouble for anybody else. The code provides no penalty for someone proposing to commit suicide in honor of the teacher. They forgot that one. However, we find that Chi Cheng Yi should now be sentenced under the statute on doing what ought not to be done to the heavier penalty therein provided of 80 blows. As a holder of official status, he is permitted the privilege of monetary redemption. In view of his stupid behavior, however, it would be impolitic to allow him to continue serving in his former position. We therefore request that he be handed over to the commander of his banner to be kept under official surveillance before he commits suicide again. He hasn't tried yet. He always does announce his intent. That was sort of a weird case. But that's part of the fun of it, in a sense. They are weird cases, and they get you trying to think yourself into the heads of these people and see why to them they weren't so weird. Yeah.
Under sexual violations.
Do you remember again which page it is so I can look at it?
Right,
22.16?
Yeah.
Got it.
Yeah,
right.
And then I saw it was really interesting because I remember you saying you're questioning why attempting murder is like less than if you actually committed it. And then they even had it there is that since it was only attempted rape, that it was a lesser sentence if you actually carried it out.
Yes.
It's interesting because he had like. I guess he broke it up like her finger anyway, so I just thought like,
Though in this case, of course, part of what's going on is that not being a virgin is going to make her less marriageable. So the actual harm done from that, I mean, one of the things I think we have to remember is that our sort of sexual mores are pretty unusual by historical standards, and that there are lots of societies where if you say, you know, what's wrong with people having sex if they enjoy it, one answer would be, because now I can't marry off my daughter, or at least I'll have to marry her off to a much less attractive husband, because men want virgin wives. And why do men want virgin wives? Well, one reason is they don't have paternity testing, and they'd like to be sure that the kids are really theirs, and so forth and so on. You know, all of these are, I would say, are, if anything, our relatively permissive society is the exception, not the rule, historically speaking, in most of these things. Of course, most societies didn't have good contraception either. Yeah?
I actually have kids on marriage. Like, the girl, I guess, slept with her fiancé before they got married, so the parents could
someone
else, and they eloped. Yes. And then, I mean, the guy got, like, 100 blows, and the girl didn't get any punishment.
Yes. But what was the guy being punished for?
It was because they disagreed.
That's right.
That's right.
The eloping is not illegal, apparently, but disobeying his parents is illegal. Well, her disobeying his parents isn't illegal, or at least it's not. I mean, they don't have any authority over her until after she gets married, at which point I guess she counts as their daughter-in-law and therefore under their authority. Yeah, no, I thought that was an intriguing...
I thought they would put more emphasis on her not going to, like, the family line that they wanted her to or something like that.
Yes, yes. Now, I don't know enough about her parents. You know, why wasn't she accused of disobeying her parents? And the answer is, I don't know. Now, it is true that wives are under their husband's authority, and so maybe there's a feeling that sort of she's under her fiancé's authority. That isn't at all clear. You know, one thing which I think was just sort of interesting, unrelated really to the course, but related to one of the things mentioned in the course, are you have this pattern sometime where the woman is brought up in the household of the man she's going to marry from a fairly young age, for various reasons. Apparently, that's been used by modern researchers for evidence on what triggers the incest taboo. That is, we know that most people aren't sexually attracted to their siblings. And one explanation is maybe something genetic, and apparently there's evidence that the couples of this sort, I think, had considerably fewer children than the average, which suggests that having been brought up with the woman he was going to marry itself triggered whatever the instincts were, and therefore made them less interested in having sex with each other. I think that's at least where modern researchers have mined the Chinese customs to get some at least very tentative information on human sexual programming, as it were. Yeah.
Is there something about the fifth degree? Like, is that what it's... Because
fifth degree of relationship.
Yeah. Is that, like, because one of the incest cases, it was the guy had sexual relations, they called it, with the daughter of his fifth degree younger cousin, and when the affair was found out, she killed herself, and they made a big deal that it was like the fifth degree. Is there, like, a difference in punishment?
I think, as a general rule, punishments depend on what degree in the mourning system relationship it is. And I think there are at least some of the statutes where the fifth is the dividing line, that is, where it's such and such a punishment, if it's no more than the fifth, then some lighter punishment or heavier punishment is more than the fifth. I don't know if that's always true. I think I remember seeing at least one where that was where they drew the line. But more generally, you've got this elaborate category of how closely related you are. And in theory, the function of those categories is to determine how long you have to mourn for somebody. So that if a relative dies, the closer relative they are, the longer you're supposed to mourn them. And therefore, a fifth-degree relative, you don't have to mourn for as long as a fourth-degree relative, for as long as a third-degree. And the mourning is pretty serious in that, among other things, if a parent dies, if I remember correctly, you're supposed to mourn the parent for, I think it's 3 years, during which time you're not supposed to have sex with your spouse. And for a while, it was a criminal offense for at least an official to get pregnant during that period of time, because it proved they had violated that. And that thing gets lifted at some point. It was mentioned somewhere in the earlier text. But the whole mourning stuff does seem to have been of some significance. But once they have this classification, then they can use it to say, when you beat that guy, how closely related he was, or when he beat you, or whatever happened. So that's why those degrees, not just fifth, whatever they are, sometimes it's fourth, second, and so forth, keep showing up through the cases. Yeah, other people's comments on cases that struck them? Let me start. What? Yeah.
The one that I thought was interesting was
The one where his disciple steals from him, or
no,
there are a couple.
He
seduces a woman. Do you remember what page it's on, or what?
Well, assault by a disciple on his master. I didn't mind by having on the page number.
Yeah.
But anyway, he ends up killing his disciple, and then the court of the commentary, whatever, said that he can't have a disciple under 40. So they said, since he had a disciple under 40, he could be destroyed. And then they said, since the disciple was a really illegal disciple, he would only be treated as a commoner. So then he got regulations due to a monetary offense.
Right.
Okay, but they say disciple. Is that like a religious disciple, or does that mean like a?
It's really. You have a monk, and then you have basically a younger monk or monk in training who is under his authority.
So are they held? I didn't understand by the text. Are monks held higher than commoners, or are they kind of?
I don't know if they're held higher, but remember that part of what determines the penalty is the relationship between two people. And the relation of a monk and his disciple is sort of like a father and his son. And that shows up in at least one of the cases, and I think maybe another. There's one case where the disciple steals money from the monk, or from the other monk, I guess, but one of them is a disciple of the other, and it's held to be a less serious offense than it would otherwise have been, for the same reason that stealing within close relations in the family is a less serious offense, because the family property is thought of as, in some sense, commonly held for the whole family, so you're really sort of stealing for yourself. Has anybody here read Kim by Kipling? Kipling's one really good novel. No, because Kim is in effect the disciple of the Buddhist Lama, who is one of the other central characters. It's a very good, if you want something good to read, Kipling was, in my opinion, a very good poet and a very good short story writer, and he wrote two novels and co-authored one other, and of all of that, one of them is a really first-rate novel. And that's Kim, and it is also a very vivid picture of India in about the late 19th century. And very sympathetic, as people think of Kipling as sort of pro-imperialist, which in a certain political sense he was, but in Kim, on the whole, the Indian characters are treated more favorably than the English. Most of the English characters, at best, are well-meaning and competent, so don't understand the land they're ruling, so to speak, with a few exceptions, and a number of the Indian characters, including the Lama, is Tibetan, not Indian. But the Lama is really quite a believable portrait of a saint. He's this sort of rather naive old man and wandering around India as a beggar because he's chosen to. He could be an important person in his own land. But it's clear that somehow nothing bad is ever going to happen to him. That you know, sort of God's hand is on him in some very vague but convincing fashion. And Kim is this streetwise brat who's the orphan son of an Irish soldier who basically went native and drank himself to death. And so Kim has grown up although he's in fact Irish, as an Indian street brat, is much more fluent in Hindi than he is in English, and is sort of a very streetwise kid, and meets this Lama, and sort of they adopt each other, as it were, and go wandering around India. It's a neat book. But anyway, that's a case of a disciple and his master. Very striking, famous case. Yes? Yeah, of the officials, you mean.
Yeah, who are denying being in the
state. Yes. Yes. I don't think he was even a servant. I think it was that his father had been a servant.
Yeah, and so the question was pretty about, because he himself.
Absolutely not. This would blur the distinctions between the noble and the base and ruin society. No, no, you can make him a general or something if you like, but never let him take the examinations. I think they're hired. I don't know. It's an interesting question. It's a question I wondered about too, why they have these. Because what's going on is that you've got the officials, and the officials are not expert in the law, for example. So they hire someone who somehow, I don't know how, has become expert in the law, and he sort of is, as it were, the right hand of the official in dealing with those things. And they presumably hire other people who are an expert in other things, I don't know what. All of these people, I think, are being paid directly by the magistrate, not by the imperial government. Of course, the imperial government's paying the magistrate. And for some odd reason, they're thought of as a low class. And they're not allowed, not only they, but their children, I'm not sure about how many generations. I think for manumitted slaves, I think for three generations, they aren't allowed to take the exams. And I don't know what the rule is for this category, but for some. Yeah, no, I mean, part of what I wondered about, but I really haven't thought it through very well, is whether somehow it's got to do with the attempt to keep the system stable. That in the back of my mind is that the system was always at risk of devolving into feudalism, because you've got a single local official with very broad authority, and you could imagine a history, and maybe it happened, because after all this is 2,000 years of history, and it may well be that there were times when things fell apart, but you could see that he could start accumulating sort of authority and ability and such, and maybe they're worried that if you blur the class of competent sort of civil servants and the class of officially powerful administrators so that you don't have a sharp line between them, and I'm the district magistrate, but my brother-in-law knows the law, maybe they're worried there about things. But that's pure guesswork, and it may be purely symbolic. And that, as I was sort of trying to recreate the diatribe in the case about where they're saying this guy, he's done nothing wrong, except that at some point, I think he didn't tell them that his father had at some... It's not even that his father spent his life as the employee. The implication is that his father, at some point in his life for a little while, was a private employee of a magistrate. And nonetheless, that means that this guy... I think what happens is, I'd have to go back to the case, but I think it's something like that. In the past, he's tried to take the exam, and then it was discovered that his father had been, and so he was punished for that, and then he did something heroic in the military, and so his commander says, all right, can't we now let the guy take the exam? And they say, no, you can do something else good for him, but you can't let him take the exam. It was a weird and interesting case, that's right, but I don't... What about, that's an interesting question, what about the district magistrates marrying people or having concubines? What's the restriction there?
They're not supposed to marry anyone.
From their own district, right, exactly. It's quite a serious offense. Or have a concubine for their own district. And again, my guess, that I may be wrong, is that what they're worried about is forming local bonds. So that if both the representative of the emperor and the local bigwigs, so to speak, you know, the rich merchants or whoever is really important, if they're related by marriage, closely linked, it's going to be a lot easier for the district magistrate to run things as he likes, lie to his superiors about what's really going on, and end up becoming a feudal lord, as it were, rather. And I may be wrong. I mean, it's not like I'm an expert in Chinese culture, but this seems like sort of one of the worries in the background. One of the other things they do, of course, is they keep transferring the magistrates. I think you can only be... I think it's a 3-year term, if I've got it right. And again, I see that as the same thing. It seems sort of stupid in one sense, because he's acquired all this local information in 3 years. He knows who to trust and who not to trust, and you know, which potential criminals to keep an eye on and such, and then you throw that away when you move him. But maybe the answer is that, yes, but we're afraid if he has too much of that, he's going to become too independent. Yeah, I mean, an awful lot of organizational questions, political and firms and everything else, are how you balance centralization and decentralization. And there are clearly advantages to both. There's a recommend for other light reading, C. Northcott Parkinson, most famous for Parkinson's Law, a British academic who wrote humorous essays making serious points. He's got one great essay where he's discussing the centralization, decentralization, and he's alternating between describing a modern firm and some point in feudal England. And the point being that exactly the same thing, that, you know, from the standpoint of the center, you know, those barons, you know, the Welsh marcher barons think that we've got nothing to worry about the Welsh. The people up north think that all we got concerned with Scots. You need a unified central vision. What it requires is an order from the Earl Marshal that begins, His Majesty commands me, and ends, disobey at your peril. And just as often, the same answer comes back from the periphery. That as for those Scots leaders you want us to fight with, one of them has died and the other one has come over to our side. The territory you want us to advance over is uncrossable by cavalry this time of the year. You need local information and it has to be up to date. And he then has the same story for the modern corporation. And sort of it's a neat point, and I think it's one of the things running through these political structures is that whole problem. And they have an interesting solution, because in one sense it's decentralized, the district magistrate is running everything, but then they've got very tight leash on their district magistrates. Other people, comments? Yes.
It's kind of interesting to see them talking about cases where men are selling their wives.
Yes.
The statute said that it couldn't do that.
Yes.
But in one case, because of the sort of the facts of the case that we have before, they read into the statute one cannot sell one's wife without due cause.
Yes.
And there was a comparison case to that where a guy was poor and he tried to sell his wife, but I think he faked his death or something.
Mm-hmm.
And because of that, they weren't seeing his punishment.
In a sense, go back to the very first case here under offenses committed by officials where a father beats and stabs his son to death. And what crime has he committed? Anybody remember first case in the book? Yeah?
I think he was
punished for being. You got it. That's correct. Now, the son, I should say, had himself committed a killing. So the father had a reason to kill his son. But the conclusion is, let me find it, here we are. Yeah, that's right. He concealed the offense. Under Boulay 1421, these are comments by the editor, wherein it is stated that a parent who kills a child because the child has struck or reviled him is not to suffer penalty. The Shen Shi Qi commentary on the code explains that the child's act of striking or reviling the parent has made the child guilty of a capital offense, because of which we may deduce the killing becomes justified. So the argument seems to be, well, here the son had committed a capital offense in killing the slave or servant or whatever it was we beat to death, therefore the father's killing him was not a crime. But the father's killing him and concealing the fact was a crime, and so the father is punished for that. Yes?
Yeah, I thought that was really interesting on whether or not it's possible, though, because I don't have it written down, but it was called voluntary confession by
yes.
the
right.
But the statute said that if a criminal confesses before anyone, discovering that they can have, free remission.
Provided that the crime has not done any bodily damage to anybody, I think.
Yeah, I thought that was kind of interesting.
Yes.
There's still a difference factor.
Yeah, you kill people, you can't do this. I think it's got to be something like theft. But yes, no, and you can see a discussion in the case where they're trying to balance, in a sense, the tension is that if you reward them for turning themselves in, it makes it easier to catch them. But if the reward is a lighter punishment, it reduces deterrence because there's not as much penalty, and they're sort of worried about the case where it goes to zero, and they discuss various cases that if you turn yourself in after it's discovered but before they've caught you, then they just lower your penalty one step. And that's probably not too bad, because one step down is still probably a pretty serious penalty. But if you turn it in some cases it looks as though if you confess before the crime is discovered, as though you go home scot-free. And that seems a little extreme. But it might also be risky. I mean, I'm not sure I would trust this whole system not to decide there are special circumstances so I don't go home scot-free, hang you instead, or strangle you instead. And the whole system, you'll also notice that a lot of these cases, you have received what we would think of as a very severe punishment long before you've been punished. Right? Think about these people who are convicted of a capital offense to be for strangulation after the assizes. They may well have gotten beaten or tortured in other ways in the course of the case itself, which is legal within limits. They are then walked 800 miles, whatever it happens to be, to Peking. They are then locked up for 3 years, punctuated with an annual exercise which decides they'll be executed. Then they're sent into exile. Well, they suffered quite a lot before they got sent into exile. But one of the things which is sort of noticeable about this system is that pretty much imprisonment itself isn't seen as a punishment. That you don't have, there was the case of the woman who's going to be in prison for 3 years, but that's clearly an exceptional case. Mostly the punishments are either corporal punishment, capital punishment or some version of exile, slave labor, that kind of stuff. And that makes some sense because it's much cheaper from the standpoint of the society imposing it. If you lock people up and they aren't slave laborers, you got to feed them, and that's costly. But it's also true if you look at the 18th century English pattern that being imprisoned, waiting your trial, could be a very unpleasant business indeed, but you didn't, for any serious offenses, see imprisonment itself as the punishment until about the end of the 18th century, as far as I can tell. It wasn't a normal part of the list of things that happened. The other comments? Yeah.
I had a question. When I was talking about female wrongdoers,
yes.
it said that there was the woman was sentenced to decapitation, and she was pregnant. They had to wait 100 days after she gave birth before they could execute the sentence. But if it was death by slicing, it was only 1 month.
Huh.
I was just trying to understand.
Yeah. As you may know, there was something like that in the English law. Again, in the 18th century, it was referred to as pleading her belly. If a woman who was accused of a capital offense was pregnant, I don't think they gave her 100 days, but I think they couldn't execute her until after she had been delivered to the child, and they might choose to transport her instead. And I think there are some suggestions about women deliberately getting pregnant in prison in order to be able to do that. But I assume that the rule you're describing is on the theory she's got to stay alive long enough to nurse the baby, and that in 100 days or so the baby no longer requires nursing, they can wean it, and that way they don't have to kill the baby to kill the mother.
Except in the case of...
Yeah, well, that's more serious, and they're willing to take more risks with the baby, I guess. I don't know. But yeah, no, that's an interesting point. Other bits that struck people as interesting in their cases? Yeah.
Wives of another
man. I had a few cases like this. Yes.
The wife would be returned to the second husband. Why would the court order that like the second husband get the wife?
I don't know. Yep.
I think in that case it was the guy that faked his death. And so, right?
There were other cases, but yeah, that's
what
the
case.
Yeah.
And so I kind of read that as they were sort of punishing the first, the original husband by...
Right. But there were other cases where, like, yeah. One, it's 223.5. One guy sold his wife to another guy who took her as a wife in ignorance of the fact that she already had a husband.
Yes.
And the first husband and the wife each got punished, but the wife has to live with the second guy.
Yes.
Why?
I don't know. That is, maybe because the first guy, Jody, didn't serve her or something. I really don't know. I mean, maybe they just figure that you want the minimum disruption and that you therefore leave the status quo. That was a point, in a very different context, but a point that struck me in the Jewish law, which we'll get to much later, is that you have these cases which basically say we have to leave things as they are except when we have a good reason to change them. And the case where that's weird is where the law is ambiguous. And we say, I either owe you $50 or $100. So what that normally means is the court will make me pay you $50. But if you've already taken $100 of mine, if you've compensated yourself, the court won't make you give me $50 of them back. Because their position is they neither know that you do or don't owe the $100. And therefore, they will simply leave things as they lie. So maybe that's what's going here, that they don't have a good reason. But I really don't know. Yeah.
I think it could also be that maybe, because in that case, the second husband was sort of deceived, I guess, because he didn't know that she
was married. But I'm not sure if that's always, that you have to look and see whether that's always the case or not, because there are quite a lot of these cases, including one of the things that's going on and that they're concerned about. Other cases that struck people? Cases.
There was one that I read where the person who had just received his election.
Yes. Right.
Afterwards, he became drunk and imagined he would get a concubine, claimed that he saw a fairy princess come up
right
out of the grave.
Yes.
And so they decided, what was the name of it? In the case of the reckless propagation of violent claims,
yes.
He was sentenced to deportation of slaves to strip of his title because of his.
Yes, but I think they did reduce it, if I remember correctly. Yes.
Yeah,
Yeah, they reduced it to 3 years. Yeah. It's originally a capital offense, and then they reduced it to 3 years. And it's pretty clear he's just drunk. But for some reason, that kind of drunking, babbling...
There were a few of those settlements where there was non-canonical
writings.
Writings.
And in at least one case, just books that hadn't been approved. As far as you go, there was anything wrong with the books.
Yeah.
Yes.
So there was a lot of men.
I think that ties to the idea of treason and all those regulations. Yeah. There clearly is a lot of what looks like very oppressive sort of regulation along those lines, but it isn't. And there were, rebellions at various points. The Taiping Rebellion, I think the Taiping Rebellion is supposed to have killed more people than World War I, is I think the estimate I've seen. You can see that they had some reason to be concerned about such things, though they mostly didn't happen. Did anybody notice the case about the poor guy whose chair carriers carried him a little too far and with catastrophic consequences? This is an official, they're having some kind of a ceremony at a Confucian temple. And the temple is sort of this walled structure, and there's another wall around it with gates. And the rules are that you're supposed to go on foot from the first gate. And a official is being brought in his sedan chair with, usually four men carrying poles, a chair, and he's sitting in the chair, and there are curtains drawn because it's raining heavily. And the bearer has come to the first gate, and instead of stopping, there's a lot of water there, so they don't want to stop. How can their master get out? So they carry him through the gate, which is in violation of the rules. And he supposedly yells at them to stop, but it's raining hard. They don't hear him. They take him into the second gate and let him out there. Three different people report this, and he ends up being seriously punished. Isn't that bizarre? And...
Is the punishment
let me see if I can find the case, because that was one of the... Here we are. It's page 276 to 278. Brian Diaz had that, and Nicola Gladys, I'm just reading this, and Michael Munters, and... Brittany Salvatore. So all the four of you should have read it, but yes. Well, you may not have. It may not have struck you as much as it struck me. Here we are. The Governor General of Hupai and Hunan has memorialized concerning Chong Lai, the now dismissed district magistrate of Huang Po Xian, who has been guilty of violating the regulations for the state sacrifices. The Temple of Confucius of the said district has outside its main gate an outer enclosure surrounded by a secondary wall through which pass two outer gates. An official coming to the Temple of Confucius to participate in the sacrifices must dismount from his sedan chair when it arrives outside one or the other of these outer gates. On the occasion of the biannual spring and autumn sacrifice to Confucius, Chong Li, as district magistrate, important person, was being carried at dawn in a small sedan chair toward the Confucian temple. The curtain of the chair was closed because of heavy rain. On arriving outside of one of the two above-mentioned gates to the outer enclosure, the two chair-bearers, or only two, saw that so much rain had accumulated on the ground that there was no place to set down the chair. They therefore wrongly carried Chong Li onward through the gate. Through the lowered curtain, Chong caught a glimpse of what was happening and shouted to the bearers to stop. But so loud was the rain that they failed to hear him as they hurried forward. The magistrate at once got out of the chair in a terrific hurry, but by then it had already been brought as far as the main entrance to the temple. So listening to that part of the description, you would say they're going to say it wasn't really his fault, The district director of schools and others were inside the temple at the time arranging the sacrificial offerings. However, a first-degree licentiate was present to watch the ceremony and happened to glimpse the incident. He reported it to the director of schools. Subsequently, two other persons who had also witnessed it presented written charges which judicial examination has failed to disprove. The Board of Punishment finds that Chong Lei was lacking in respect when he participated in the sacrifice of the Temple of Confucius. His failure to dismount from the chair in time, though occasioned by the great accumulation of rainwater on the ground and the error of his chair bearers, nevertheless constitutes a violation of the established regulations. The law is the law, right? Accordingly, he should be sentenced to 100 blows of the heavy bamboo under the statute on violation of imperial decrees. Because he has already been dismissed from his position, and hence is now technically a commoner, the sentence requires no further deliberation. It has been found that Hu Qichuan, one of the two persons who presented written charges against the magistrate, although a purchaser of official rank and belonging to the category of unclassed officials, was yet improperly wearing the golden button of the seventh rank. He was wearing the insignia of a higher rank than he had. His case will receive separate consideration. So you can see that catching the eye of officialdom is pretty dangerous, even if what you're doing is reporting things. And my suspicion is that the reason he gets so many reports is that everybody's afraid that if he doesn't report it, someone will report him for not reporting it. But it's a pretty striking case. Now, to some degree, you get a similar pattern in our legal system, in the sense that if I make an error in driving, which results in an accident, the amount I owe in tort damages doesn't depend on how, mostly doesn't depend on how much at fault I was, though I have to be in some sense at fault to be liable. It depends on the purely accidental fact of whether I crippled three people or just scraped somebody's paint. So in that sense, to some extent, our legal system holds people liable for things that in a certain sense were not their fault. But this seems like a pretty extreme case of it, and yet they don't seem to have any doubt after giving... I mean, it's not like they try to make him look bad in the beginning. It's just, you know, he committed an offense. You've got to punish the guy. Right. So I thought that was sort of one of the more interesting cases to me that struck me. Something I noticed, something else, just a minute. This has to do with this question of getting off for turning yourself in. In these kinds of crimes, if a criminal were allowed at a 1 degree punishment reduction simply for giving himself up after learning that the authorities wanted him, he would accordingly be entitled to a 2 degree reduction when, having learned a charge was about to make him, he voluntarily surrendered himself in advance. Furthermore, according to statute, it would be possible for such a criminal, by turning himself in before the crime became at all known to the authorities, to gain complete remission of punishment. But if such remission were permitted for major crimes of homicide, punishable by decapitation or strangulation, there would then be no means to deter the violent. It follows that despite Lang Yaju's voluntary surrender, he should not on this account be granted a reduced punishment. Now, of course, the issue is not reducing it to zero in that case. It's just reducing it, so it doesn't have a whole lot to do with it. But they are at least making the point of the tension between inducing people to turn themselves in and reducing the punishment such that they don't get deterred anymore. That we have... Right. Is it in statute or is it only in sort of... So it's discretion, but we normally would let people off much more lightly if they turn themselves in. No, I think that's right. But I don't think we generally say we let them off scot-free under those circumstances, at least. Though I suppose you would have a suspended sentence, which you might think of as a scot-free in some senses. Looking to see whether other particular... Yeah, a couple of the things that struck me also is they seem to make a not very sharp distinction between deliberate and accidental homicide, between, I guess, what we would call homicide and manslaughter. That there's this category of killing in an affray, which seems to cover sort of any case where, for some reason, I'm in a fight with somebody else and one of us gets killed. And a lot of those are accidental killings, or at least the ones they describe. So you've got a case where two people are having a fray, and one of them grabs a musket and fires it in the air to scare the other one, and the bullet happens to hit someone else who's got no reason to try to kill at all, who's some distant relative, killing in an affray, what's the punishment? And they work it through. And there seems to be a fair amount of that sort of stuff going on. I think... I think the case where somebody puts on a fireworks show and it starts raining heavily and the people are trying to get away. It's on the mountainside somewhere and some of them are killed. I think he's held responsible. I don't remember if that's killing an affray or not. But there seems to be a noticeable number of cases where it's true it's worse to kill deliberately. And maybe what's happening is that killing an affray ends up with execution after the assizes and therefore probably isn't really execution, whereas killing deliberately, maybe it's execution before. I'd have to look at the cases. But there does seem to be a lot of it's what the result was rather than what your intent, or at least that the result of killing has very serious consequences even if it wasn't deliberate. What's, aside from killing your son, your child under some circumstances, what are the cases where you are or aren't allowed to kill somebody? As an ordinary person is. Yeah? That's clearly a distinction. But there's also a distinction, though, which exists in our law. Yes? Yes.
Like our system, they just transferred
things. Yeah.
What if
the wife
or
consequence back to the husband's in-laws? Not
that
he has a right killer, but not very well punished. For doing that, yes. Yes. No, it's clear that there's a set, and that's sort of like the father-son case. But the other category is that you're allowed to kill somebody in order to prevent a crime, but you're not allowed to immobilize him and then kill him. And that I think is our, it's dependent on the state, but I think that's our distinction as well. That many years ago, I happened to be a witness to a shooting in Philadelphia, and the result was that I had some opportunities for casual conversation with police. I think my wife ended up testifying, I didn't, but we were sort of sitting around the courtroom and such. And a policeman gave me two pieces of advice if I ever had somebody break into my house. The first, this assumes that I'm in a position to kill him. That I've got a gun or something. He says, the first is make sure he ends up dead, because if he's dead, he can't give his version of what happened. And the second is make sure that when we arrive, the body is inside the house. Because it is illegal if someone breaks into your house and you pull a gun and he sees it and he starts running, it's illegal for you to shoot him and kill him. But it is in many contexts, probably not in all states, legal if he's inside the house, you reasonably believe that you can't stop him without shooting him for you to shoot him. And in some places, I think it varies by the state, whether if you could run away from the house, you are then legally obligated to do so if the only alternative is killing him. But I think in at least a fair number of states, the rule is that you are not obligated to run away and are entitled to defend your house with lethal force. Yeah. That's right. Same argument. That's right. You know, it struck me in a sense as evidence that police are not particularly law-abiding. That they're giving you what they see as good advice, but they don't really assume that there's any sort of moral obligation not to commit perjury, for example, which he was implicitly suggesting you do, which was consistent with some of my other experiences. I think that not that police are worse than anybody else, but you shouldn't assume they're any better either, that they're, you know, human beings and so forth. Anyway, all right, well, we will continue this next week. I hope you're enjoying Imperial Chinese Law as much as I am.
Yes. I think maybe the pages might be a little bit different, because I really
Possible.
I really don't remember reading that case.
That's possible. Which edition is it? Sure, because there have been...
I don't know. It was hardcover. That's all I remember.
Yeah, I don't know. There have been only two editions, and they may be...
What? Because my 276... 276 started with a gunpowder case.
Let me find out, then. Because you're perfectly right. It hadn't occurred to me, but it may well be that my page numbers...
Either way, everyone's reading everything. It might just not be lined up.
Yeah. Well, except that I might have the wrong end point.
Oh, yeah.
276.
Did you think the pages were a little funny?
Yeah, I just kind of went straight across and read what was right across my name.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it made possible that the one in the library is a different edition, and therefore
the
fact that hadn't even occurred to me. But this one is... No, the 276 is not a gunpowder case.
Yeah, that's all right. Fine.
I'll have to look. Well, next year I'll try to fix that.
The other thing that I wanted to mention, I'm thinking about the paper and... I'm interested in a few pages tonight. Yeah. So there's the Lex Mercatoria and
yes.
Hansa and yes. the Lubeck Law and like
yes.
the
all of that could be very interesting.
Yeah, and in some ways they're related, but they're yes. all different.
I'm trying to remember. There's somebody I know at Florida, a law professor. They will come to me in a bit. Who's written on Lex Mercatoria?
And Mr. Gemmell has a chapter in his book about it too. And
that would be a start, but then get look at the references.
Right. Follow those further.
Yes.
And it fits in
and
well.
And if you email me about it, I'm sure I can find it. Somebody I know. It's just that I'm terrible on names. And
terrific.
Who I know has written about it.
Yeah, I don't have like a thesis.
But that set of stuff would be interesting to try to understand more clearly. Now it's got the disadvantage that scholars have looked at it already, whereas many of these, they haven't very much, but you haven't and I haven't.
Exactly.
And so see what you get at it. Yes.
Here. Oh, I was just thinking about paper topics also.
Yes, good.
I told you that in fall, but I think looking at it's not going
to be a better idea.
Yeah, yeah, all right. So I was thinking about looking at the triad, like, because you're talking about, like, mafia, and I was kind of doing, like, the triad system.
Yeah,
like,
yeah, there's enough known about it, yeah.
Yeah, I looked online, and I think I found a book that hopefully I can find through the library and stuff.
Right,
just not very good.
Yeah, that'll be fine, yeah.
Okay.
No, if you can, if the information is there, yes.
Okay.
I mean,
cool.
It's... I was talking about the mafia. It's not trivial. I know one good book basically on the mafia, and there maybe is another, but it's not easy to get the information, and it tends to get obscured by the fact that you've got newspaper people who want to tell sensational stories, and you've got prosecutors who want to get convictions, and don't care if they're telling the truth, and all the rest of it. But I would have thought that if you could find good sources, that would be
acceptable. Like from UCLA Law School.
Yes.
Or UCLA. I forgot his name, but he wrote a journal on that he had a whole bunch of tracking them all the way to China.
Yeah, that's great.
Okay.
Right.
Sunday is the last.